Okay, and here we go with the Monday edition of Mideast Migraines for Monday, January 5, 2015. Honest to goodness. Oh yay. Time for the show to actually begin. The part where you can hear my lovely voice. I am Ren Tawil, your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American here on the left coast of North America. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, January 5, 2015. And you are hearing us by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting to the city of at 101.3 on the FM dial, and we are streaming live at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Follow the instructions on our main, on our webpage to receive our free streaming link. And please don't forget, if you can't hear us streaming, there's a good chance that we're out there broadcasting on the old-fashioned radio waves, 101.3 FM. And if you cannot hear us on the radio waves, there's an even better chance that we are streaming, freakradio.org. Keep that in mind. Do not panic if you cannot hear us on one venue or the other for whatever reason. We just keep in mind that we're alive and well, and we're at least trying to broadcast from wherever we are to wherever you are. Okay, we'll give this a rest here. Lovely music from Egypt, specifically the album The Musicians of the Nile, Luxor to Izna, 1989 Real World Records Limited. The last piece you were hearing there, we were about halfway through, the lovely Yatir Allah Shad Yara, or O Bird Upon the Tree. And before that, you were listening to Zarafat al-Said, Rejoicing in Upper Egypt. What better venue or reason to rejoice anywhere than in Upper Egypt? Before I actually began the show, we were listening to track number one, Al-Bar al-Gharam Wasa, or translated into English, Love is as Vast as a River. Again, that is the Musicians of the Nile, Luxor to Izna album, 1989. And again, my name is Ren Tawil. This is the Mideast Migraine Show. Let's toss some of these out to put us in the best possible mood. Officer, I know I was going faster than 55 miles per hour, but I wasn't going to be on the road a whole hour. If you were going to shoot a mime, would you use a silencer? I busted a mirror and got 7 years bad luck, but my lawyer thinks he can get me 5. I installed a skylight in my apartment. The people who live above me are furious. Let's see. We're already at the bottom of the page. I am, anyway. If you were going to shoot a mime, would you use a silencer? I think I already said that one. I got food poisoning today. I don't know when I'll use it. My dental hygienist is cute. Every time I visit, I eat a whole package of Oreo cookies while waiting in the lobby. Sometimes she has to cancel the rest of the afternoon's appointments. They say the universe is expanding. That should help ease the traffic. You know how it is when you go to be the subject of a psychology experiment and nobody else shows up and you think maybe that's part of the experiment? I'm like that all the time. Always remember you're unique, just like everyone else. The sign said 8 items or less. So I changed my name to Les. If I tell you a joke in the forest, but nobody laughs, is it a joke? Was it a joke? It is good. Is it good if a vacuum really sucks? Think about that, folks. The sooner you fall behind, the more time you'll have to catch up. I watched the Indy 500, and I was thinking that if they left earlier, they wouldn't have to go so fast. That's wise. If heat rises, heaven must be hotter than hell. Stands to reason. Una conciencia tranquilla es generalmente el sino de una mala memoria. Now, I don't know if that's part of this actual list. It looks like it's from my interlingual list. Somehow got transferred over. My PC is so strange. When I have a kid, I want to put him in one of those strollers for twins, then run around the mall looking frantic. I'm donating my blood to science fiction. Stephen Wright is a lot more fun to watch on TV and listen to and carefully examine his blank, emotionless face and his beady eyes and his frantic hair. It's been a long time since I've seen. Is he still alive? If Stephen Wright is still alive, or if anyone has the latest dope on me, call me here at the station at area code 831-427-3772. That's area 831-427-3772. Stephen Wright. These are all quotations by the great stand-up comic. That's the bottom of that list. Maybe it's time to retire that list. Hey, folks, I'm just trying to put us into the best mood, but this is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, January 5, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Now, I'm looking for... I really do have some interesting items. Let's just take a look at the latest e-newsletter from Jewish Voice for Peace. JVP in the news. This is good for, did I say weekly? Look, apparently this is a monthly. Time flies when you're getting older. This is good for December 4th through January today. Happy New Year's, everyone. Happy New Year, everyone's. Here is some of the fantastic work of JVPers around the country covered by national and local media in December. So inspiring to see all the things that we do together. Here's to a year of solidarity, community, and the pursuit of justice. Onwards, Naomi. Let's just take a look at some of these. Another very important reminder, I am not an official outlet or carrier or any kind of a sponsor, in legal terms anyway, for Jewish Voice for Peace. But I do love to read you from their material. And being a Palestinian American, you might have to do a double take and kind of shake your head twice, doubly, and say, wait a minute, what's a Palestinian Arab American doing quoting a bunch of Jews? Well, this particular group of Jews are primarily American Jews who find that they are not in allegiance with the state of Israel, that Israel does not speak for them. In fact, there's a lot that Israel can do, a great deal, to lessen the stress, tension, and violence in the Middle East, which it is not doing. Israel simply does not speak for them. Let's see if I can come up with an appropriate article here. Once again, it's been a heck of a week, folks. From the New York Times. New York Times Magazine. Can liberal Zionists count on Hillary Clinton? By Jason Horowitz, December 17. Here, let me read that. Come on. Let me read the title of the article again. Can liberal Zionists, and what kind of a creature could that possibly be? Can liberal Zionists count on Hillary Clinton? By Jason Horowitz. Daniel Zemel, first visitor to Israel, fresh off his bar mitzvah, 1966. a bookish Jewish kid from Chicago, Zemel had a love for Israel inherited from his grandfather, Rabbi Solomon Goldman, a friend of Albert Einstein's, who was president from 1938 to 1940 of the then left-leaning Zionist Organization of America. I take it to mean Rabbi Goldman was the president, not Einstein. President of the left-leaning Zionist Organization of America, with the other members of his Jewish education group. The 13-year-old Zemel spent 2 weeks in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa. He lunched in cafeterias with the kibbutzniks he idolized, ate frozen treats on the beach, and climbed a lookout tower peering into Jerusalem's still-forbidden old city. A year later, Zemel was ecstatic when Israeli forces captured everything he had surveyed and beyond, including the Temple Mount, the West Bank, and Gaza, in the six-day war with Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. Over the decades, as Israel matured and began to wrestle with the occupation, Zemel did too. He visited Israel again and again as a college student, a rabbinical student, and an assistant rabbi in Minnesota. My quasi-pseudo-native Minnesota, by the way. In 1983, Zemel became the head rabbi of Temple Micah in the northwest section of Washington. In the constellation of liberal American synagogues, there are a handful that stand out for their political engagement and the influence of their members. Leo Bake Temple in Los Angeles, Congregation Beth Elohim in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and KAM Isaiah Israel on Barack Obama's old block in Chicago. But none have more connections to Capitol Hill. In the fall, Zemel, a contemplative 62-year-old with horn-rimmed glasses, a bushy mustache, and a bald dome from which his skull cap incessantly slips, stood before his congregation in a state of unrest. It was the start of the Jewish New Year, and he had decided to express his anguish over Israel in the form of a sermon about the direction his beloved country had taken. All summer, during the war in Gaza, Zemel and many of the members of his progressive congregation had been racked with worry. In his book-lined office, decorated with an Israeli flag and a poster of Yoda holding a Hebrew Bible, emails from congregants have been regularly popping up on Zemel's computer screen, railing about Israelis, quote, killing children. Zemel sat with congregants as they wept on his couch. The entire year 5774, in fact, was a trying one for Zemel and other liberal Zionists, who increasingly find themselves torn between their liberalism and Zionism and stranded in the disappearing middle between the extremes of a polarized American Jewish community. Micah's liberal Zionist remained wedded to a two-state solution for Israelis and Palestinians and estranged from the policies of a right-wing Israeli government, along with the reflective Israel can do no wrong sentiment on Capitol Hill. But they also felt alienated by Jewish groups to their left, some of which chanted, "Stop the murder, stop the hate, Israel is a racist state." Zemel, fighting a nagging cold, looked out at the robust crowd on Rosh Hashanah. He knew that the people gathered before him, and the people they knew, could help determine United States policy toward Israel. Some of them even had a direct line to Hillary Clinton, the early favorite to be the Democrats' nominee for president in 2016. Sarah Ehrman, who is 95 and a veteran of Jewish American politics, was a mentor to Clinton. She sat next to Maria Echaveste, a former official in Bill Clinton's administration and a convert to Judaism, whom President Obama nominated to become ambassador to Mexico. Al Fromm. It's difficult when you see two words that happen to be someone's first and last name, which looks like something else completely. Al Fromm, A-L-F-R-O-M, an architect of the Democratic resurgence of the 1990s and advisor to Bill Clinton, sat across the aisle. Arrayed around them sat newspaper, magazine, and television journalists in a congregation that included David Gregory, a former host of Meet the Press, Jake Tapper, a CNN anchor, and Dana Bush, a Washington correspondent for CNN and the former wife of Jeremy Bash. Her name is Dana Bash. I think I said Bush. Dana Bash. Washington correspondent for CNN, former wife of Jeremy Bash, who was a national security official in the Obama administration. Another member of the congregation is Alan Cooperman, director of religion research at the Pew Research Center, which a year before published a landmark portrait of Jewish Americans that showed, among other things, that less than a third of young Jews said, quote, caring about Israel was essential to their Jewish identity. I'll read that again. Alan Cooperman, director of religion research at Pew Research Center, a year before published a landmark portrait of Jewish Americans that showed, among other things, that less than one-third of young Jews said that caring about Israel was essential to their Jewish identity. Just taking a quick look at what's going on here, folks. Oh, very nice. Okay. Zemel adjusted his skull cap. And by the way, he's using the word skull cap in this article here. I believe it's properly referred to as a yarmulke. So I just inherently believe that the term skull cap, even as often as it is used, may be taken as a slight by some people. At any rate, I continue. Zemel adjusted his skull cap. Quote, tonight we celebrate the creation of the world, he said. But in this season, we also take a look at ourselves. We acknowledge our past, our errors, who we are. What better time to look in the same way at the only Jewish country in the world? The events of this summer actually only strengthened my decision to speak about Israel and American Jewry's ongoing and evolving relationship with that mystifying, infuriating, yet enchanting place. End quote. As the sermon progressed, Zemel became more impassioned. He recounted the story of the reprisal murder in July of a Palestinian teenager from East Jerusalem by Israeli extremists. I am so ashamed, he shouted. He bemoaned the growing ultranationalism in Israel by saying it had, quote, dragged through the mud what he called, quote, the greatest ethical tradition in history. Heads nodded in the pews. In many segments of American Jewry, Zemel said, one is free to disagree with the President of the United States, but the Prime Minister of Israel is sacrosanct. How patently absurd! Zemel's criticism of the current Israeli government pivoted to a discussion of how the Holocaust and that summer's flare-ups of anti-Semitism in Europe reminded them all that Israel was existentially necessary. We must love Israel even harder, he concluded, quoting from the Israeli national anthem, Od lo avda tikvatenu. We have not yet lost our hope. A reminder, I am reading from the New York Times Magazine, the article by Jason Horowitz of December 17, Can Liberal Zionists Count on Hillary Clinton? For Zemel and his faithfully Democratic congregation, that hope and anxiety has come to rest most squarely on Hillary Clinton. This has happened at the same time that Clinton has staked out a firmly hawkish, pro-Israel position on Gaza and Israeli security. In August, many liberals were discouraged after reading a Clinton interview with Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. In it, she struck a tone on Israel that was markedly more hardline than that of the Obama administration, generally avoiding empathy with Palestinian losses and asserting, if I were the Prime Minister of Israel, you're damn right I would expect to have control over security, end quote, on the West Bank. Asked about her tough talk, liberal Zionists tend to blame the requirements of American presidential campaign politics. A vast majority of Jews care far more about social issues and the economy than they do about the issue of Israel and will always vote for the Democratic candidate. Democrats who are Jewish will turn out in droves in support of her, Chaim Saban, a media mogul and major Clinton campaign financier, told me. And the Jewish donors? He said, without a doubt. But Clinton knows, Hillary Clinton knows, that there is a wealthy and influential sliver of more moderate Democratic Jews for whom Israel is a priority. They are less conservative than the GOPs, the Republican Party's top Jewish donors, like Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire casino owner, but feel protective enough of Israel that they could plausibly support a Republican if they sensed anything less than complete support from a Democrat. The political arithmetic for Clinton is easy. Knowing you can take the larger liberal Jewish vote for granted, you support Israel's right-wing government to keep moderates from bolting. The political quandary for liberal Zionists is that, as part of the Jewish majority that will vote for Clinton regardless, they aren't in a great position to make demands and are reduced to hoping that Clinton secretly agonizes over the issue as much as they do. Saban, the major Clinton campaign financier, told me that Clinton was pained by the consequences of Israel's actions, not just publicly. I can tell you that privately she has expressed empathy for the Palestinians, he told me. She has, quote unquote. Victor Kovner, a Democratic bundler who has a Chuck Close painting of Hillary Clinton hanging in his New York office, assures fellow liberal Jews that Clinton is on their side. She is running for president. This isn't true self time, he said. He suggested that Bill Clinton had demonstrated a much more nuanced view. But other Clinton supporters have no patience for hand-wringing liberal Zionists, especially because there is little daylight between them and Clinton on actual policy. What do they want her to do, said Ann Lewis, a senior advisor on Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign who was involved with Jewish issues. The standard line for Hillary Clinton, who declined to be interviewed for this article, is that she has been a consistent voice for Israel and for peace over the last quarter century. But other Clinton intimates, including those in Temple Micah, say they have watched her position shift by degrees over the decades. Ehrman, for one, recalled an early iteration of Hillary Clinton as a promising liberal voice on Israel. Ehrman first met Clinton during George McGovern's 1972 presidential campaign in Texas. Back in Washington, Ehrman hosted Clinton, who had landed a job on the Watergate committee, in her apartment for a year, and the two became close. Ehrman later drove Clinton to Fayetteville, Arkansas, telling her all the way that she was making a mistake by giving up a promising career to marry the quote-unquote country lawyer Bill Clinton. And I'm just taking a look at some of these. Whoops. Okay. Continuing here. In the early 1980s, Ehrman became political education director of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the country's most potent pro-Israel lobbying group. Political education director of AIPAC. When the Clintons came to Washington as president, and first lady, Ehrman became deputy political director of the Democratic National Committee. "I did all the Jewish stuff around the White House," Ehrman said. That work culminated in organizing the Oslo Accords ceremony, at which Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin shook hands with the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat on the south lawn of the White House, sealing an agreement between Jews and Palestinians to end their conflict. On the morning of the signing ceremony, Hillary Clinton called Ehrman with a special reward. "I want you to stand at the front door of the diplomatic entrance, the main entrance, and I want you to see them coming in," Ehrman recalled her saying. The event was a high point of liberal Zionism's harmony with Washington politics. "It was totally, totally amazing," said Zemel, who also attended the event. Clinton's interest in the issue did not end there. In May 1998, speaking via satellite to young Arabs and Israelis gathered in Switzerland for a conference, she became one of the first people associated with the Clinton administration to call for a two-state solution. "I think that it will be in the long-term interest of the Middle East for Palestine to be a state," she said, adding that the territory that the Palestinians currently inhabit and whatever additional territory they will obtain through peace negotiations should be considered a functioning modern state, end quote. The White House, seemingly uncomfortable with her statement, clarified that she was expressing a personal view. Her willingness to embrace the Palestinians soon caused another problem. In 1999, Ehrman accompanied Hillary Clinton on a trip to Ramallah in the West Bank, during which Clinton listened to Suha Arafat, the wife of the Palestinian Authority leader Yasser Arafat, deliver a speech in Arabic accusing the Israeli government of gassing Palestinian women and children. At the conclusion of the remarks, Clinton embraced Suha Arafat and offered a customary peck on the cheek. The moment news of the kiss hit the wires, a high-ranking Clinton administration official placed an angry call to the cell phone of Rob Malley, a Middle East advisor to the president, who was traveling with the First Lady, demanding that he fix the problem. But the damage to Hillary Clinton was done. Criminy. The next day, some New York Jewish leaders seized on the incident to discredit Hillary Clinton's candidacy for the United States Senate, which was unofficially well underway. The New York Post, the New York Post ran a front page headline reading, "Shame on Hillary." It was around this time she enrolled in political Hebrew school. Under the tutelage of the senior New York Senator, Chuck Schumer, she became extremely adept at winning the trust of audiences who held an absolute pro-Israel position. Schumer did, however, need to assure attendees at one campaign fundraiser that, and I quote, "she will look to me to see how to vote," end quote, on Jewish issues. Clinton was elected to the Senate in 2000 and struck a tone that was in sync with the Bush administration, which had aligned itself with the Israeli right. In 2007, she went further than the administration when she released a position paper calling for, quote, "an undivided Jerusalem," end quote, as the capital of Israel. In 2008, as a presidential candidate, she warned Tehran, the capital of Iran, that America would, quote, "totally obliterate Iran if it attacked Israel." By this time, Clinton was an AIPAC favorite, and AIPAC had changed from the time that Ehrman had worked there. Founded in 1954, To strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship, regardless of political ideology, the lobby has become increasingly conservative in its politics and orthodox in its membership, while developing an unparalleled network of donors across the, around the country. Its financial power, demonstrated at annual mega-conferences that bring together presidential candidates and congressional power brokers, has translated into legislative might. AIPAC-backed bills on, for example, support for the Israeli military or sanctions against Iran, usually pass unanimously in Congress. Unanimously, folks. By many liberal Jews, alienated by AIPAC over the years, were encouraged when Barack Obama ran against Clinton in the 2008 presidential primary. They appreciated that he took a more nuanced position when it came to supporting Israel, one that better reflected the political debate within Israel and among American Jews. I'm going to read that sentence again. I think that's really important. Many liberal Jews, alienated by AIPAC over the years, were encouraged when Barack Obama ran against Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential primary. They, liberal Jews, appreciated that Obama took a more nuanced position than Hillary Clinton when it came to supporting Israel, one that better reflected the political debate within Israel and among American Jews. Continuing now, they saw him as the rare presidential candidate who spoke their language and who seemed willing to push Israel toward peace. They expressed relief when he said that you could be committed to Israel while criticizing the policies of the right-wing government. Quote, here is, let me see, who is he now? Okay, I guess this is Obama speaking here. Quote, I think there is a strain within the pro-Israel community that says unless you adopt an unwavering pro-Likud approach to Israel, that you're opposed to Israel, that you're anti-Israel, he said, Obama said, and that can't be, that cannot be the measure of our friendship with Israel. Wow, what a hard-hitting paragraph that is. And a lovely color picture here. If not, okay, wait a minute, yeah. Caption, Hillary Rodham Clinton, then Secretary of State under the Obama administration, and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, in Jerusalem, November 2012, facing each other off behind their respective podiums with a number, great and utterly backed by alternating American and Israeli flags with Hebrew and a menorah emblem emblazoned upon the front of the podiums. Okay, continuing with the text part of the article. Once elected, Obama seemed to understand that he needed someone to lend him credibility with the Israeli government and its American defenders, a tough friend of Israel who could muscle the country away from settlements and toward a peace agreement. An aide to Obama called Malcolm Hoynlein, the executive vice chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish American Organizations, and asked him to call Hillary Clinton to see if she would be, quote-unquote, agreeable to being named Secretary of State. Early in her tenure as Secretary, she was harshly critical of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the country's increasingly conservative culture, surprising and appalling AIPAC and many of her supporters in New York. See, excoriated Israel settlement growth and the quote-unquote anti-democratic tendencies of its right wing, and also the practice in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community of gender discrimination, quote, reminiscent of Rosa Parks. As Clinton pressured Israel to make peace from the State Department, the Obama administration looked to J Street, a new and progressive Jewish lobby, to give members of Congress financial backing and credibility on Israel so that they could support the president without fear of being cash-starved by AIPAC or called anti-Israel. J Street boasts of helping Obama defeat an AIPAC-backed bill that would have scuttled the administration's Iran nuclear talks. For the most part, though, unquestioning support for Israel has remained dominant in Washington. Even before she left the administration, Clinton essentially shed any pretense that she was still playing the role of impartial arbiter. As Israel flouted her own government's demand that it not build any more settlements in East Jerusalem, Clinton spoke so effusively about Netanyahu at a December 2012 conference that political observers considered the speech tantamount to a presidential announcement. Since then, Clinton has further distanced herself from her job as Secretary of State, making light of her role as Netanyahu's disciplinarian for Obama, and calling herself the president's, quote, designated yeller, end quote. This explanation of Clinton's earlier rebukes of Israel is already gospel among her pro-Israel supporters. Lewis, a backer of the independent super PAC Ready for Hillary, told me that Clinton, quote, was not in the lead on policymaking. Clinton's return to campaign form has left liberal Zionists with little choice other than rationalization. I sense that the people who advise Hillary Clinton on Jewish politics came of age in an era when the rules of the game were different, Jeremy Ben-Ami, the founder and president of J Street, told me, suggesting that the time of reflective support for Israel, regardless of their government's policies, had ended. When I asked if he could persuade Clinton that such a position was no longer tenable, he answered, not so convincingly, "We definitely need to try." Other liberal Zionists are hoping that Bill Clinton would be a more sympathetic voice within a Clinton White House. After Zemel's Rosh Hashanah sermon, in which he talked about the need for, quote, Jewish genius to solve the problem in Israel, Al Fromm told me, Bill Clinton has this little bit of genius. Zemel concurred, I want Hillary, he said, so I can get a second round with Bill. Very long article, folks. We're getting through it. There are definitely the tone of this article infers that one has to have some familiarity with the ins and outs of the most inside of Washington politics. Then again, if you have the patience and the ear to listen to this article, one apparently is gaining quite ability of the inside nuances and inner circle mumbo-jumbo just by listening to this article. So let's continue. We're getting there. We're getting to the end here. Hang in there. Over the summer and fall, many of Micah's congregants and other influential liberal Zionists around Washington aired their discomfort with Hillary Clinton on Facebook and in op-ed pages and journals. But they were made even more uneasy by the specter of an increasingly loud Jewish left wing that is openly hostile to Israel and advocates punishing it economically. At a Shabbat service in August, Zemel's 22-year-old daughter, Ronit, a senior at McAllister College in St. Paul, you may recall I said that's former home of mine, the Twin Cities. Runny, the senior at McAllister College in St. Paul, sat in the front row of Micah's sanctuary. She listened to her father say, "What is needed to make peace between the peoples of these two lands is probably more than humans can summon," end quote. Which is from My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, A History of the Country's Ethical Struggle Since Its Independence, by Ari Shavit, a columnist for the left-leaning Israeli paper Haaretz. In a few days, Zemel's daughter would head back to school, where she had served as co-chairwoman of the student wing of J Street, known as J Street U. The idea of going back to campus, she told me, gave her, quote, the worst feeling ever. She felt besieged by pro-Palestinian groups advocating boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, modeled after the boycott movement that helped end South African apartheid policies. I'm more ashamed of Israel now, she said, but I am viewing it from a place of love and caring, and I know that they are, and I know that they are not. So I'm very scared, end quote. Shavit expressed a similar concern. In November, he visited Temple Micah, and speaking as a, quote, liberal to liberals, he worried about young American Jews losing their Jewish identity and drifting away from Israel. Chief among the fears of liberal Zionists were groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, which in June helped provide a Jewish seal of approval for the Presbyterian Church to divest from companies seen as profiting from Israeli occupation of the West Bank. Rebecca Vilcomerson, the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, said that as a result of the war, the summer war in Gaza, 60,000 new supporters signed the group's online petitions or open letters in liberal Jewish publications. Phil Comerson, whose sister and an entertainment writer is a friend of mine, a friend of the author of this article, said she felt no sympathy for the concerns of liberal Zionist agonists, whom she considered toothless and intellectually dishonest in their attempts to reconcile their liberal values with Israel's right-wing government. She reserved special indignation for what she referred to as PEPs, P-E-Ps, or politicians who were, quote, progressive except for Palestine. Vilcomerson pointed to a Pew poll taken during the summer which showed that the core constituencies of the Democratic electorate, people under 30, African Americans and Hispanics, blamed Israel more than Hamas for the war. She was also encouraged by the angry response of some delegates at the 2012 Democratic National Convention who booed an amendment to the party platform that would recognize Jerusalem as the present and future capital of Israel. If the left wing makes the case to Clinton and her Democratic successors that the political calculus on Israel is changing, then, Vilcomerson predicted, they'll be forced to recalibrate their position. Hillary Clinton, she said, quote, is totally politically calculating. While Lewis says that Clinton should, quote, take seriously the increasingly intense conversation about the appropriate support for Israel, Clinton, at least for now, is not budging. After all, Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator often mentioned as a more liberal alternative to Clinton, has taken much the same position. I would not argue that there is something to worry about, Lewis told me. In November, Zemel took 30 of his congregants to the synagogues. On the synagogue's annual trip to Israel. It's exactly the sort of pilgrimage that Zionists consider the most effective means of strengthening a connection to Judaism and as a result of increasing American Jewish support for Israel. But Zemel and his delegation saw signs in the region that troubled them. A third intifada seemed possible in East Jerusalem, where Muslims and Jews clashed over holy places. Palestinian extremists ran over Israeli commuters and stabbed worshiping rabbis. Right-wing Israeli government ministers promoted the spread of settlements and proclaimed the death of the two-state solution. In November, they also proposed a bill that seemed to dilute Israel's commitment to democracy by explicitly declaring the country a Jewish state. Netanyahu forced the Justice Minister, Tzipi Livni, a favorite of American liberal Zionists, out of his government. Out of his government. One is torn, Zemel told me from Tel Aviv. I can't imagine not wanting to come to Israel every chance I get. But what would happen if an Israeli government were to decide, okay, we're going to declare the entire West Bank to be part of Greater Israel and we're not going to grant the Palestinians full citizenship? How could I then come to visit this country? But how could I not come? I just can't imagine it. Zemel always felt Israel should be able to chart its own course without the United States or any other nation forcing its hand. But as the tour progressed and the group encountered stun grenades and concrete blocks in Jerusalem, Zemel said he began to believe that Israel needed an emergency intervention from the United States. If a person is killing themselves, he told me, you save them from themselves. But there is a sinking feeling among many liberal Zionists that Washington's opportunity for intervention is past. The Obama administration's efforts to broker an Israeli-Palestinian peace have collapsed, and its attention has turned to terrorist groups like ISIS and the curbing of Iran's nuclear program. European nations, frustrated with what they consider America's unwillingness to force Israel to get out of the West Bank and embrace the two-state solution, have begun to recognize Palestine. Clinton has shown little inclination to risk political damage by reprising her old role as a friend and a critic of Israel. At a Brookings Institution forum in Washington on December 5th, Clinton addressed an audience of American Jews and Israeli officials, including Livni, Tzipi Livni. She offered platitudes about the two-state solution and studiously avoided any of her past criticism of Israel. On her way out, as she shook hands and gave hugs, I asked Livni, who is trying to oust Netanyahu in elections in March, if America's liberal Jews should have any expectation that a new, more progressive Israeli government could form. It's not only their hope, she said, it's our hope. It's not only their hope, it's our hope. Zemel was discouraged by Clinton's remarks. She didn't say anything, he complained. But he, too, clung to the idea that she had a private view that coincided with his own. I hope, he said. It's a theme that Zemel often returns to when talking about Israel. On Yom Kippur, the holiest day in Judaism, he told a Micah congregant who was depressed about Israel's rightward lurch that Jews were, quote, a people of endless patience who, quote, view things in the long term. At the breaking of the fast at his home that evening, he showed off a 19th century text that belonged to his grandfather. When he led the, at the time, when his grandfather led at that time the Liberal Zionist Organization of America, which is now a right-wing group financed in part by Sheldon Adelson. Despite everything, Zemel remained optimistic, telling me that the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow was a Zionist anthem. Quote, there's no place like home. What could be more Jewish? Jason Horowitz, a correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, certainly knows how to write. Certainly seems to have contacts, or at least people that he has access to. And then again, this is this very long article is from at least the New York Times online version. Magazine. It just says magazine up here. The fact that it's from the New York Times can have people going every which way in terms of its viability, in terms of whether or not one can trust him or it. Let's take a quick look at the comments on this article. It is 4:01 in the afternoon, this Monday, January 5th, 2015. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz here on the left coast of North America, some 70, 80 miles south of the liberal hotbed of gay old San Francisco, whatever that might mean to you. By the way, Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcast to the city of Santa Cruz primarily at 101.3 FM, and we stream live at freakradio.org. Past programs of Mideast Migraines and its earlier named incarnation, Mideast Madness, can be found on two separate websites, radioforall.net, that's R-E-D-I-O, the digital character for A-L-L.net, radioforall.net, my archives of my recorded programs can be found there, radioforall.net. You can also go to Santa Cruz Media Center, Indie Bay, Santa Cruz, of course, being two words, S-A-N-T-A-C-R-U-Z, Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Santa Cruz Media Center, Indie Bay, so you can catch up and refer to earlier mentioned readings, articles, subject matter, and recorded interviews. It's all there. Looking for, 354 comments to this December 17th article. 2.5 weeks ago. Tony Silver in Copenhagen said, "The major cause of tension and extremism, not only in the Middle East region, but in the whole world, is Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would take away much of the motivation for terrorism. Would take away much of the motivation for terrorism," my emphasis, obviously, in repeating it, "and the radicalization of Muslims in the world." "Everyone's been saying that for years," Tony says. "We should start sending security bills to Tel Aviv." "The mother of all terrorism in the world is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There was no ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Hezbollah, Boko Haram, Muslim Brotherhood, or even Hamas before the invention of Israel. Israel was created by Irgun and gangster Zionism terrorists." Gangster, interesting. Referring to what was called the Stern Gang back in 1948, or came to be known as that. He calls it the gangster Zionist terrorist. That's cute. That's clever. Led by Menachem Begin, who later became Israel's prime minister. I indeed am totally in agreement with that. With that comment posted in response to this Horowitz article here. Excellent. I'm going just going down the line here until I find something that's highly critical of the leftist bent of this article. Dr. Svetistefan, New York City. "Hillary can't be counted upon to support anything. She is not inner-motivated. If she holds core beliefs, they are as invisible to liberals as they are to conservatives. That said, she is Machiavellian in that she will do whatever it takes to ingratiate herself with power. She aped Obama's hard hostility to Israel when it was politics, all the time keeping doors open to Jewish donors, more or less saying, 'Don't take this seriously.' as Michael bellows below. That's not what it says. As Michael below in this letter says, quote, liberal and, quote, Zionist are moving in opposite directions. If liberal is meant to mean idealistically blind to realities and seeing partners for peace where there are none, the opposition really isn't between liberal and right wing. The opposition is between childish dreams and real politik. And, okay, so I'm reading these backwards, obviously, in chronological order, most recent first. And the quote by Michael, referring to liberal and Zionist are moving in opposite directions, is right here. Michael in Los Angeles said, there is no such thing as a liberal Zionist. It's 2014. Of course, the article dates back to the 17th of last December. Rosalie Lieberman in Chicago said, before most of those, Mr. Horowitz in his article is living in a vacuum, as if it's only dependent on what Israel does or doesn't do that creates peace between two sides. What does the other side really want? What do the PLO and Hamas charter say? What do the majority of polled Palestinians in the West Bank want? They want violence, confrontation, a total, quote, right of return, so much for two states or even a binational state, and Israeli Jews out. They want bloodletting. Not more than 20% really think differently. And as a group, they are too weak to change this policy. If elections were held today in the West Bank, Hamas would likely win, or Islamic Jihad. Would that change American policy? Perhaps the leftist liberals would call for recognizing Hamas. They'd love it. They know how to play the game and manipulate the gullible into thinking. Of course, they're willing to recognize Israel along the 1967 lines for maybe 1 week, 1 month, and then dot, dot, dot. Okay, I've run across this sickening sentiment so often. More of the same old stance in favor of Israel. Rosalie Lieberman, as she or whoever calls themselves here, wants people to pay, as she says here, it's as if one is only dependent on what Israel does or doesn't do that creates peace between two sides. What does the other side really want? And then she talks about the PLO charter, the Hamas charter, which say some pretty terrible and frankly stupid things, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many people, portions of it, regarding the Jews. So she wants us, in other words, she explicitly does not want people to pay attention to what Israel is actually doing, or what Israel is not doing that it probably should. She wants people to put all the weight on what is written down on paper in the form of the Hamas Charter and other charters. She wants people to pay more attention to written, inscribed, textual threats rather than what, say, Israel is actually doing to the native Palestinian Arabs. That's why I refer to this sentiment as sickening. She wants to put this writer, this commenter here on the Jason Horowitz article in the New York Times, wants everyone to pay attention to the threatful rallying cries of certain Arabs in the Middle East, depicting all of them as purely anti-Semitic, not responding to or not reacting to terrible things that the Israelis have done, that Israeli Jews have done in founding and maintaining their state. And I often hear this reference made to at least one poll that was taken whatever number of years ago, of Palestinian Arabs in the West Bank, intended state of Palestine, free Palestine, Samaria, Judea, whatever one prefer, whatever one prefers to call it. These polls, I've seen a number of polls, not only of Palestinians, but of Israeli Jews, which say remarkable things. And there is a myriad of questions and a myriad of answers provided to those questions. On the one hand, one finds a great deal of support for a two-state solution, not only among Palestinians, who those who are not Jews, but amongst Israeli Jews. And even other polls, or even some of these same polls, include questions which have uncovered answers among Israeli Jews that say that a great number of them do not want their Jewish children sitting in the same classroom with Arabs. Answers which reveal, and I have spoken about these specific poll results on previous programs. It's been a while since I've addressed it. But they say things like, the answers come up that, yes, we admit that Israel is an apartheid state, but that's okay because this is our land, or because the land was given to us by God, etc. Answers that say, essentially, we admit that Israel is not truly a democratic state. And apparently these answerers of the surveys and polls feel comfortable with revealing those truths. Maybe I should talk more about surveys and polls and questionnaires amongst those who live in Israel and Palestine more in my next show. It's 4:13 p.m. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren, coming to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial and streaming live and free at freakradio.org. Here's the phone line to the studio. And by the way, if 4:14 p.m. and January 5th jive with your personal time-space continuum, then you know the show is live, so you may call me here at area code 831-427-3772. Again, 831-427-3772. 427-3772. The lines are open. I'm listening. I'm watching the board. When I began the show this afternoon, I was looking desperately for... Oh, God, I hate it when this happens. I came across an email which was the text of a beseeching cry for new programmers, new blood, raw meat, as it were. Maybe that doesn't jive with the liberal crowd, but those who would be interested in producing and hosting their own program on free radio here in Santa Cruz, California, Santa Cruz County, California. We have many open time slots in our current schedule, which can be found at freakradio.org. You can see our schedule there, at least the schedule which we maintain as the official series of time slots for our programs, produced both locally and away. So-called can shows and programs from our own past, as well as programs that make themselves available to us, produced by various other, mostly commercial radio services. There are, as I said, a great number of open slots. We would like to fill them with dues-paying show producers, quite frankly, as ever, with this kind of underground, illicit, and community, utterly community-oriented radio stations, we are financially strapped. The need for donations is right now is probably as bad or as great, depending on how you want to view it, as it's ever been in our 20-year history. Free Radio Santa Cruz will be celebrating our 20th anniversary in 2 months, folks. March of this year, 2015. Big celebration. We're still throwing the details of that together. 20 years of liberating the airwaves. As of this year, anyway. As of right now this year. So I was looking for that email, which I transferred, I thought, to one folder, and now it's gone. Go to our free radio website, and let's see here. Let me go. Yes, I do have it in front of me. And let's just take a look at that page, shall we? The contact link. Studio line, as I've already given you, is 831-427-3772. Of course, if you call that with details about a show that you would like to produce or that you think someone else might want to produce with us, if you were to call the studio line, you run the risk of not being answered if no one is here right now and we're running pre-recorded shows, or if someone is here, I certainly hope that they, as ever I will, friendlily pick up the receiver and talk to you, but it might serve as a slight interruption. Never mind that. I do not want to discourage people from calling in, but there's the studio line, and then there is your opportunity to send the details via email, frsc@freakradio.org. That's as in Free Radio Santa Cruz. The email address is frsc@freakradio.org. Contact us that way. We do receive a great deal of messages along that comm line. There's also snail mail, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office, Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, zip 95061. Again, Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Again, if you have internet access, which is virtually everyone these days, or so they make us believe that's the case, just go to freakradio.org, click on the contact link, and you will be reminded of the details. You're certainly, if you do want to do a show or would have us consider having you as a programmer, you're invited to fill out an application, which you can download from our site, fill it out, and mail that to us, if you wish, along with a demo tape or CD. I want to emphasize it is not necessary for one to forward a demo tape or a demo CD, compact disc. I don't think very many, if any, of the applicants for programs in the two and a half plus years that I've been doing this show have ever bothered to provide one, but you're free to send in a demo of your work, or what you propose to be your work. We are looking for original, creative, new programming. We are especially interested in having more diversity, of course, goes with the territory. If you think that you can offer something to the community on our station, please apply today, Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. Go to our website at freakradio.org if you're not already there. Click on the contact link. And that's us. That's just us all over the place. Okay. Still recording here. You can go to Free Radio. You can go to radioforall.net for the archives for this show, or Santa Cruz Indie Bay. I also re-upload copies of my program there at Indie Bay. You may also email me by way of this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.org. That's the old name of the program, MideastMadness@G as in George, M as in Micah, X as in Xerxes.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. You may email me at that address. I'm tired of seeing spam. Not referring to you, of course. Okay, let's take a rest from the old monotony of my voice and have some more lovely music from the Egyptian Nile. Time is Fleeting. No, that is not the English translated name of that piece of music. Once again, from the Musicians of the Nile Luxor of Izna, 1989 compilation. You were just listening to the first part of, long piece of music there. First part of Kolele Kolbo Ankawa, Everyone Has Had a Broken Heart, and that was preceded by Allah al-Ali, the tall palm tree, and you even heard a rendition of some horse steps there for a few seconds before the music began. All right. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Certainly some of you out there have heard the news. Once again from the New York Times, I do not select my articles by the source or the publication that they first appeared in. I am attracted to the subject matter, the title of the article, and some other factors. This happens also to be from the New York Times. Palestinians set to seek redress in a world court. By Jody Rodorin, December 31st, just 5 days ago. Jerusalem, reporting from Jerusalem anyway, President Mahmoud Abbas moved on Wednesday to have the Palestinian Authority join the International Criminal Court, opening a new front in the Middle East conflict that could lead to war crimes prosecutions of Israeli officials and that risks severe sanctions from Washington to Jerusalem. And that, of course, refers to sanctions against the PA, the Palestinian Authority, or as it prefers to be called, the State of Palestine. Continuing with article, the step is part of a strategic shift by the Palestinian leadership to pursue statehood in the international arena after decades of failed American brokered negotiations with Israel. It came a day after the defeat of a United Nations Security Council resolution that demanded an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory by the year 2017. They even give them a good 2 or 3 years, and it still failed. Continuing here, quote, "There is aggression practiced against our land and our country, and the Security Council has let us down. Where shall we go?" Mr. Abbas said at his headquarters in the West Bank city of Ramallah. As he signed the Rome Statute, the founding charter of the court, and a number of other international conventions. "We want to complain to this organization," he said of the court. "As long as there is no peace and the world doesn't prioritize peace in this region will live in constant conflict. The Palestinian cause is the key issue to be settled," end quote. An American State Department spokesman called the action counterproductive, arguing that it would only push the two sides further apart. "It is an escalatory step that will not achieve any of the outcomes most Palestinians have longed hoped to see for their people," Jeff Rathke, the spokesman, said in a statement. He continued, "Actions like this are not the answer. Hard as it is, all sides need to find a way to work constructively and cooperatively together to lower tensions, reject violence, and find a path forward." Mr. Abbas, whose popularity plummeted after the battle between Israel and Hamas over the summer, has been pressed by other Palestinian leaders and the public to sign the statute and then use the court to pursue cases against Israel's settlement policy and its military operations. But the step could have major repercussions, not least because Palestinian officials could also be charged by the court. Israel and the United States have promised to respond harshly to the move. Quote, there is no question mark as to what are the consequences that there will be immediate American and Israeli financial sanctions, said Khalil Shikaki, director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. He continued, those sanctions will gradually become more and more crippling, and this could indeed be the beginning of the end of the PA. They fully realize that. A poll in December by Mr. Shikaki's group found that just 35% of Palestinians approved by the president's performance, approved of the president's performance, down from 50% before the fighting in Gaza, from 50 to 35. If there were elections now, we were kind of talking about this a moment ago, folks, this article from 5 days ago. If there were elections now, the poll found, Mr. Abbas and his more secular Fatah party, more secular than Hamas, obviously, would be defeated by Hamas, the Islamist faction that dominates the Gaza Strip. So even Mr. Abbas's crew acknowledges that. Continuing, reconstruction in Gaza after the devastating war has stalled. Reconstruction in Gaza after the devastating war has stalled amid continuing acrimony between Hamas and Fatah, despite an April reconciliation pact. And analysts said Mr. Abbas was desperate to show that he was effective. They have to take some meaningful steps to recover anything of their really shredded credibility. Nadia Hijab, executive director of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, said of Abbas's team. She continued, that fig leaf of action is growing steadily more tattered. They keep saying it's a new paradigm, and they want to use international tools, but now they have actually been put on the spot. End quote. Meeting after a ceremony marking Fatah's 50th anniversary, the Palestinian leadership decided to return to the Security Council in the new year when changes in its membership make passage of the resolution more likely. That would force an American veto that the Obama administration has tried to avoid. Afterward, Mr. Abbas made a show of signing the papers to accede to the international conventions. Though the Palestinians cannot take action under the agreements for up to 90 days, a window of time that some in Washington are counting on to calm the situation. But Israel is scheduled to hold its own elections on March 17, and Prime Minister Netanyahu and other politicians may be eager to show a strong response to what they have long said would be an aggressive unilateral act. Quote, Mr. Netanyahu said in a statement after the signing, quote, it is the Palestinian Authority, which is in a unity government with Hamas, an avowed terrorist organization that, like ISIS, perpetuates war crimes, that needs, the Palestinian Authority needs to be concerned about the International Criminal Court in The Hague. End quote. He continued to say, we will take steps in response, and we will defend the soldiers of the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, he added, referring to the Israeli Defense Forces, we will rebuff this additional attempt to force diktat on us, just like we rebuff the Palestinian appeal to the UN Security Council, end quote. Aaron David Miller, a regional expert at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, said that, quote, in a single move, Palestinians have managed to buck up the Israeli right, end quote. To give Mr. Netanyahu, quote, a great campaign issue, end quote, undermine his opponents, quote, and alienate the Americans in the process. That was Aaron David Miller in Washington. The signing came 8 months after Mr. Abbas stunned Washington and Israel by having the Palestinian Authority join 15 international treaties and conventions at a time when 9 months of American brokered peace talks were near collapse. The agreements Mr. Abbas signed Wednesday cover a host of cross-border concerns, including organized crime, safety of United Nations workers, biological diversity, hazardous waste, international waterways, nuclear weapons, and cluster munitions. But the most significant is the one with the International Criminal Court, created in 2002 to prosecute genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. It currently has 122 members, the court does, including most of Western Europe, but not Israel, nor the United States. The Palestinians asked the court in 2009 to investigate Israeli actions during Operation Cast Lead, a three-week military offensive in Gaza, but the request was rejected because they lacked the required United Nations status. A 2012 vote in the General Assembly upgraded Palestine to a non-member observer state, and some Palestinians had been urging Mr. Abbas to sign the Rome Statute ever since. But questions remain about Palestine's qualifications, and in any event, it is up to the court to decide which cases to pursue. Okay, I'll not read the rest of this New York Times article. Obviously, the article is perhaps remarkably critical, or conveys criticism by others of the PA's actions and its president Mahmoud Abbas's actions, critical of them, and in lieu of any discussion, which is generated by calls to the station. As far as I know, our phones are working. I think we had trouble with the phone lines earlier last week, or earlier than that. I think we're up and running now. Phone. You can still make your call to area code 831-427-3772, 831-427-3772. And until I get more input from my listener audience on that, let me just go ahead and make my personal comments. When one reads about the inherent restrictions, matter, of course, restrictions against the Palestinian Authority, which thinks of itself as, officially anyway, the State of Palestine, restrictions by lack of full membership in the UN, lack of recognition probably by a majority of nations in the world as a state, given the restrictions that are forced upon it by Israel's refusal to create some action on the ground toward what Israel has said time and time again, yes, we support a free and democratic state of Palestine alongside a secure Israel. We keep hearing about the necessity of having Israel to be a secure state, but almost never about Palestine being a secure state. In spite of those well-intentioned comments by Israel, which they only say, in my opinion, to convince some the most naive majority of the rest of the world that they mean business, Israel does everything it can to prevent the state from coming about. And as long as the state doesn't exist, there are these roadblocks into implementing the wishes of the PA by being able to carry through a complaint to the ICC, to the criminal court. There are inherent roadblocks to being recognized as more than an observer state in the UN. And in having the kind of status that the United States presumably will grant it if it were a full state, and until that status comes about, the U.S. is going to continue to veto very often, singularly, alone, amongst the five permanent members and 15 total members of the UN Security Council. The U.S. will continue to say no, no, no. It is the U.S. that says no, 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 tied to the hip with Israel. Who can deny that? What thinking person can deny that the U.S. government is tied to the government of Israel? And I know it sounds like I'm rambling on here. That's what happens when I feel I have so much to say, and I try to cram it into a single sentence or paragraph. But here, New York Times article by Judy Rodoran from 5 days ago expresses a certain cynicism and constantly repeats the problems that a number of people have with the PA making these moves, where, but as the article admits in a couple of places, that's the part that I read, what else can they do with no real movement on the ground towards peace with Israel. They're between a rock and a hard place. They're painted into a corner. What else can they do, folks? Okay, now that I've read that article to you, I have I was led to this particular New York Times article that I just read from a link on Daily Kos, you know, KOS, I believe that's somebody's name. And now, surely enough, I cannot get to the... Okay. I believe Robert Naiman was the person responsible for... Here it is. It's just slow, folks. It's in spite of what you may think about my slowness or my fastness. It's the computer is not helping matters. This extends from an article by Robert Naiman, "Let's Not Punish the Palestinians for Joining the International Criminal Court, the ICC." Oh, boy. Yeah, this actually, Robert Naiman is active with MoveOn, purveyor of many causes, petitions, and points of view. Robert Naiman, N-A-I-M-A-N, with MoveOn.org. List dispatch here. This is dated New Year's Day. Yesterday, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas applied for the state of Palestine to join the ICC. The application is expected to be approved by the ICC. If Palestine is admitted to the International Criminal Court, it would mean that Palestinians could bring cases to the ICC specifically against the Israeli government for their confiscation of Palestinian land in the West Bank, which has been used to expand Israeli settlements, undermining the possibility of a two-state resolution to the conflict. Exactly the kind of inherent problem I was talking about with Palestinian land constantly being absconded by Israel, squatted upon by Israeli Jews exclusively. That's who these settlements are intended and built for. When they, you know, if they can't stop this tsunami tidal wave of settlements encroaching onto their territory, how else can they continue with a resolution to their problem? Naiman continues here. It would also mean that Palestinian violations of international law, such as Hamas firing rockets into civilian areas in Israel, would potentially be subject to the ICC jurisdiction. It's important to keep in mind that this goes both ways, folks. And Naiman wants me to urge President Obama and my representatives in Congress to defend the right of Palestinians to join the criminal court by signing their MoveOn petition here. And... Okay, now, he says here, I just put up a piece at Daily Kos about our campaign, and in the roughly 9 minutes left of the program, I'm hoping to be directed to that article. You got it. Indeed. Here's the article on Daily Kos, again on New Year's Day. In 2015, Let's Not Punish the Palestinians for Joining the ICC, by Robert Naiman. A proposed New Year's resolution in 2015, Let's Not Punish the Palestinians for Joining the International Criminal Court. No doubt some members of Congress, presumably the ones who aren't busy resigning for felony tax evasion or defending themselves from schmoozing with white supremacists, obviously referring to some recent developments in Washington, will try to gin up an outrage festival and demand sanctions on the Palestinians for exercising their rights. Quote, ring out the old, bring in the new. Let's ignore these voices. Let's see if we can find 10 conscientious members of Congress who are willing to say, actually, the Palestinians have the right to do this if they want, and they shouldn't be punished for signing up for the rule of law. End quote. It's kind of funny, not in a ha-ha way, how twisted the public discourse in the U.S. is that we even have to defend the proposition that the Palestinians should join the ICC if they want. But we do. Exhibit A, the New York Times editorial that I just read the first half of to you, slamming Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas for applying for Palestine to join the ICC. The quote-unquote liberal New York Times editors concede that, and he quotes here, the prospects for a two-state solution grow dimmer by the day, with the Israeli government led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu steadily expanding settlements, making the creation of a viable Palestinian state harder, end quote, and that, quote, in joining the International Criminal Court, the Palestinians could bring charges against Israeli officials for cases against their settlement activities, end quote. But then, in complete contradiction to that which they just conceded, they claim that, and I quote, Abbas's actions will almost certainly make the situation worse, setting back the cause of statehood even farther. Sadly, like still too many American liberals, the NYT editors claim to oppose Israeli settlement expansion in the West Bank, but object far more strenuously to anyone actually trying to do anything concrete to stop it. Is it any wonder that prospects for a two-state solution grow dimmer by the day when the purported tribunes of American liberalism oppose any practical and concrete measure to try to save it? Fortunately, in 2015, we don't need to rely on the, quote, liberal New York Times to defend the basic principles of decency and fair play. We can do it ourselves. You can write to Congress and the President. Here, and he gives a link. Robert Naiman is policy director at Just Foreign Policy. So he's really with Just Foreign Policy, using MoveOn.org as a conduit, which is perfectly fine. Here's a poll. I'm going to make my vote. The question is, Palestinians shouldn't be punished for joining the ICC. I've given my answer. Vote number 104. The results so far are 80% in agreement with the statement Palestinians should not be punished for joining the ICC. 84 votes. 80% agree and 19 disagree. Interesting. Okay. Well, folks, it's 10 to 5. We've got an earlier edition from late last week from the International Middle East Media Center, their program, Palestine Today. It's a 3 or 4 minute long headline show. Reporting from the West Bank, the latest antics that Israel is up to, pretty much. In trying to download the current, presumably and hopefully today's episode of Palestine Today, I note that the latest one they have available, I believe, was New Year's Eve, December 31st. So that causes me to worry. Was their Ticket to Ride only good until the beginning of 2015? Did their funding run out? Did they stop on the cusp of one old year and the beginning of a new year to take stock in what they can do, what they can afford to do? I don't know what the deal is with IMEMC, but as I said, we're going to have to settle for a report from last Thursday or Friday. I think this would be Thursday's report, or Wednesday's. And we'll just, we'll have to settle for that this week. God. And let me take a quick look around here. For those out there who know what I'm talking about, I have been terribly distracted for the last 10 minutes by impinging interfering music coming from another room. Again, those of us who know what I'm talking about, this is just to let you know what's happening there is obviously quite deliberate. Someone is trying to interfere with my show by cranking their music up way too loud. I hate to have to say such things when it comes to Free Radio Santa Cruz, but this is the nature of the beast. These are the kinds of restraints and ongoing threats that we are under here. It's really bad right now. I do want to let me remind everyone that couple of PSAs or public service announcements. Folk legend John McCutcheon in concert. January 14 of this new year, Wednesday, and apparently that's at the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz. Okay. Well, the show is almost at an end here. John McCutcheon in concert in a couple of, in about 10 days, 9 days. Wednesday, January 14th. Atheist Happy Hour is also coming up this week. This Friday, Atheist Happy Hour, we meet, the group meets. Slipped there, my tongue. Every second Friday of the month. We meet at Rosie McCann's, downtown Santa Cruz there, 1220 Pacific Avenue, between 4:30 and 6:30. You do not have to attend the entire 2 hours. It is a social, monthly social get-together of local atheists and agnostics, and really anyone else who sees, who has an interest in attending that event. Second Friday of each month, including this Friday, January 9th. All right. I'll crank up the automatic cueing device, and let's go into the most current edition. That'll fit within a 5-minute time span anyway of Palestine Today. Thank you for joining me. Join me next Monday at 3 in the afternoon or this Saturday for the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, currently reading from the book Freedom Sailors. Saturday at 11 a.m. Ta-ta.